Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
Welcome to Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The FBI surveilled Chicano activists and organizations as insurgents. The Brown Berets, La Raza Unida Party, Reyes López Tijerina, Rodolfo Corky González, José Ángel Gutiérrez, César Chávez. The last four individuals mentioned are considered the four horsemen of the Chicano movement. José Ángel Gutiérrez is a founding member of the Mexican-American Youth Organization and a founding member and past president of the Raza Unida Party. Gutiérrez has written books on the FBI investigations into two of his fellow horsemen, activist Reyes López Tijerina and labor leader César Chávez. Today, we'll focus on the investigations into Chávez. César Chávez tirelessly led the United Farm Workers Union. Gutiérrez, himself a target of FBI surveillance, argues that national law enforcement organized against the poor, farm workers, and those it considers threats to society, activists. He argues the FBI has probably surveilled every Chicano leader and movement since the 1930s. The FBI's files on César Chávez were declassified in the late 1990s. Gutiérrez spent thousands of dollars to gather over 2,000 pages of FBI documents about César Chávez that cover a 10-year period, 1965 to 1975. Gutiérrez's 2019 book is entitled The Eagle Has Eyes, The FBI Surveillance of César Estrada Chávez of the United Farm Workers Union of America. Gutiérrez says Chávez and the labor movement were natural targets for the federal government.
Well, because we're a capitalist country. We see people that are socially active and organizing labor, demanding better wages, better working conditions, the progressive movement, the left of the United States, and white supremacy and racism that's been existing since forever. The Naturalization Act of 1790 said that the first citizens of the United States were free white males over the age of 26 with property. Take it from there. Anybody who's not in that definition has never been a citizen until they struggled and protested. That's what the whole issue was about the women. Native Americans didn't get the citizenship till 1924. The whole civil rights movement by blacks and browns in the 60s was because despite of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, they weren't enforced. So we had to take to the streets and protest. So we all became targets and enemies.
Chávez, during this whole time, obviously, was fighting for union rights. He got together with Filipino farm workers, and that's where the organization began. And again, the investigations started. Calls kept coming in that Chávez is a communist. Did all this eventually lead up to why Chávez not only became a target of the FBI, but also of other competing unions like Teamsters or other people who just hated Mexicans in general? Because you point out in your book that Chávez received a lot of death threats. There were bombings in the offices. There were letters, there were phone calls, and there were calls made to the FBI. But even though you did find files on all those reports, you also found that nothing was ever done about them by the FBI.
Correct. It wasn't that they were trying to find criminal things on Chávez. They were doing criminal things on Chávez and never would give him a hand. So stop to think. What do you do if you're the leader of an organization and the very people that are supposed to protect you from local police all the way up to the FBI are the ones doing the evil? What do you do? Like the song Ghostbusters, who do you call?
In your book, you point out that Chávez was under a lot of pressure, you know, much later after he founded the United Farm Workers. All this pressure from the FBI, pressure from other unions or union efforts across the country who wanted to bring him on board. Ultimately, you insinuate that he kind of lost touch with reality. He became increasingly paranoid. He didn't run his union well. There were people who were upset with the way he ran things, and they left in protest. So you paint Chavez not necessarily as a hero, as perhaps maybe some school children might learn about Cesar Chavez now that they can learn about Cesar Chavez. But you actually portray him as a human being, but you also say that a lot of what the FBI was and was not doing led to that disconnect from reality for Cesar Chavez.
That's correct. That's why it's so important to get the balance of the files, these 3,040 pages that they're going to release to me if I can get the money. That's true. Maybe the secret is there, and I'll come back to that in just a minute. But, you know, think about this. Chavez was getting his people not only arrested but murdered. There were 9 farm worker people murdered, and you can't get any investigations. The police are complicit and so on. So, again, who do you call? And think about it. The families of these people that are beaten, arrested, and jailed, who are they going to call? They're going to call Chavez. Now, what do you do with bail money and lawyers and court cases and death threats on yourself and so on when you know that you're under siege? Well, he did one thing. He started moving away from farm workers. You know, he was in Delano downtown, and then he moved to the edge of it, and then he moved into the mountains where nobody, he had any contact with farm workers anymore. So I think he was kind of running away from the danger as well as the problems that he faced all the time. Now, if you look at the literature on Chavez, the first books that came out were all glorifying and making him a saint. Perhaps he was, because he was very religious, and he had all those icons all the time with him in those marches and protests and things. And he had a lot of clergy working with him, marching with him, and getting beat up with him, too. Now, the second half of the literature begins to be critical of him. And so I got to wondering, well, what's going on? And these FBI records begin to show that, well, he was under extreme pressure and danger all the time. And he was arrested several times himself. So he's in the hands of the enemy, and he knows what they're capable of. So let's just stop for a minute and look at a comparative note of what Hoover did to Reverend King. You know, they mailed his wife. This is on the eve of him getting the Nobel Peace Prize. They mailed his wife photographs, underwear, female underwear, recordings of sexual sounds, and said to her, your husband is having all these extramarital affairs and you're so stupid. The letter, and also it was also another letter sent to him directly, insinuating that he had to kill himself because all this was going to be made public. Well, he didn't kill himself, and it didn't get made public, and he got the Nobel Peace Prize. But think about what happens to a person and their relationship with their wife when this kind of neutralization campaign and scurrilous lies are sent to the household. You know, I think he kind of began to see, Chavez, that this possibly could be done to him. And his wife did find some notes there that perhaps could have been romantically linking him with some young volunteers, some young girls. Because she left him for several months. Now, I don't know the real reason for all of that, but it implies that she left because she found these things and she wasn't satisfied with his answers. So she didn't leave him. Well, suppose there's more. Suppose there's more king-like material that was sent to Mrs. Chavez and others. Maybe that was enough for him to go off the deep end. I don't know. Maybe the second batch of documents will show us that.
Jose Angel Gutierrez is the author of The Eagle Has Eyes, the FBI surveillance of Cesar Estrada Chavez of the United Farm Workers Union of America, 1965 to 1975. When we come back, Cesar Chavez begins to lose his grip on the Farm Workers Union and seemingly with reality.
So he made some very tactical mistakes, but this was a strategic one that he lost his army, his own army.
More with Jose Angel Gutierrez, next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Since the days of J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI has investigated people and organizations it views as insurgent. Famed labor organizer Cesar Chavez was a target of government surveillance. Chavez was accused of being a communist. Constant surveillance while also being a target of death threats and office bombings was enough to derail Chavez from reality. Chavez's paranoia extended into his inner circle, and he began to look for traitors within his own ranks. He fired his legal team. He moved the United Farm Workers headquarters from Delano to an isolated compound he called La Paz, and he forced the remaining staff to play the game, a so-called therapeutic tool that employed truth-telling sessions in which participants expose each other's innermost weaknesses. Activist and author Jose Angel Gutierrez writes about this in his 2019 book, The Eagle Has Eyes, the FBI surveillance of Cesar Estrada Chavez of the United Farm Workers Union of America, 1965 to 1975. Gutierrez says the game was the final straw for many of Chavez's loyal followers.
Just follow me here with his logic. If you do see a social worker or you see a psychologist or a psychiatrist, to be sure, they ask you to tell your stories, you know, and they sit there and listen for you to bare your soul and tell your stories. And they recommend all these people that telling the truth and being outspoken about what's bothering you is healthy, mentally healthy for you. Well, I don't know if it is or isn't. And he thought this was very, very important for him to adopt into his program because he was then beginning to be paranoid about, of all people, communists in his group and radicals in his group. And so he wanted to have these sessions called The Game where his people, a certain select number, he would tell people, you are going to The Game. And they would sit around and reveal themselves, bare their souls and criticize one another, supposedly without fear of retaliation. And this was Chavez's way of listening to someone who had other thoughts than the party line, if you will. Well, Chavez was gathering intelligence on his inner core about what they thought and how they thought. And so this was very destructive as well. Because, you know, once you say to somebody, no, esa Norma, she's a sellout, and Norma this and Norma that, Norma's not going to forget what was said to her face and who said it. So things didn't quite get back to normal after those events. And this thing was very destructive to the cohesion and group solidarity within the union. And eventually it got so bad that he had to stop because it was even getting to him and to Dolores and others, and they weren't able to cope with this. And people just stopped going to meetings or taking advantage of what they learned to retaliate on personal agendas. It was just a terrible decision to do that.
So this was sort of towards the end of Chavez's life, his involvement with the United Farm Workers. He did die young at the age of 66. And in the end of your book, you postulate what could have happened if Chavez had lived beyond those 66 years. What could have become of the union? Can you tell us a little bit about your thoughts?
Well, you know, the other big error that he committed that's in the book is that one day he just decided to call off the boycotts. Now, that boycott was the way he had an international network of supporters. So when you stop your army from doing their work, who do you call? Who do you have?
That's right. You had you wrote that he stopped the boycott so that he could focus more on electing political figures.
Well, Robert Kennedy.
Specifically,
he put all his eggs in one basket, and of course he did do that, but then Kennedy was killed that same day. So then, you know, who do you call? So he made some very tactical mistakes, but this was a strategic one that he lost his army, his own army. People who could raise funds, middle-class white women, you know, going along with the program because of the pesticide thing that he raised and the birth defects and all these things. I mean, this was a crazy, crazy suicidal decision, but he took it. And then he fired his top legal team. He just got rid of them all. I don't know. I don't know what was going on in his mind or why. And we certainly did not know what really caused his death because the wife refused to have an autopsy. So we never know why he died in his sleep.
Again, these decisions that he made on his own to cut off the boycotts, he really didn't like to have any advisors. He kind of saw himself as the figurehead of the whole union. And even though other people were giving him advice, he would not take it. And I'm sure that there were people who were telling him, you have got to keep the boycotts going. What are you doing by going off in this different direction?
You know, that's always a dilemma for movement leaders. And again, from personal experience, I can only share what I went through. There's always a conflicting pattern in your own life. One, you're the leader of a cause. And the other, you got to be a CEO to maintain the organization. These are different skills. These are different tasks. These are different agendas and priorities of your personal time. And Chavez never could reconcile those. He always thought of himself as the causa leader and didn't give a damn about the business of the union. But he wouldn't listen to anybody telling him how to run the union.
You're mentioning your personal experience. You obviously have a big standing in the Chicano movement. You are co-founder of La Raza Unida Party, the Mexican-American Youth Organization. You serve political office in Texas in Crystal City. And you're also considered one of the four horsemen of the Chicano movement. You have FBI files open on you already. You know that. And the phone connection that we have right now, it's a little skippy. And not jokingly, you say it's probably because of the FBI. So can you explain how you've managed to keep your head steady, whereas perhaps Cesar Chavez didn't have that ability or didn't have the support system around him? What is it around that maybe differentiates the both of you and maybe some of the other people in the movement? Again, I just want to find out, how is it that you've managed to not go down that path that Cesar Chavez did of just constantly feeling paranoid and pursued and threatened?
I don't know. All of us, are victims of our own circumstances. We don't choose our parents. We don't choose our name. We certainly don't choose our phenotype. There's a lot of things that are just circumstances, and you deal with the cards that you got dealt with. I don't know. I differ from Chavez in the sense that I wasn't not nonviolent. I wasn't a violent person, but I certainly believed in self-defense, and all my people were always armed. And when we faced the Rangers, they knew that we were armed. They also knew that about a third of us in Mayo, we were about a third of us were military. The U.S. Army trains us as soldiers to kill. So the Texas Rangers and others knew that, too. I was in the military. I'm discharged honorably from, service during the Vietnam stuff. So we weren't just mocosos. We weren't just high school kids or college kids with, long hair. I never had long hair. I had a mustache. But I also used to wear my Army fatigue, jacket often, and so did others. So the enemy knew who they were facing. And let's say if I've got 300 people and the Rangers show up with three or four, how many of us can get killed by them before they run out of bullets? So it's circumstances and training and skills. We did upset the apple cart with just the word Chicano. They didn't know what the hell that meant, but they did know what it showed. We were not like our parents or grandparents who bowed their head and said, sí, señor, and were submissive and afraid. We were not. And I think that's because we were that third generation of children since the Mexican Revolution. From 1910 to 30, you have 1 million Mexicans coming across the border seeking to get away from bullets, okay? That's the critical core that led to who we were. So a political generation is basically 20 years among the people that study this. So by the time we come around, in the 50s and 70s, that third generation, we said, this is home. We knew that when we went to Mexico, they didn't like us. We knew they didn't like us in the United States. So we began to develop a strategy built around us liking ourselves, our food, our language, our style, our dress, et cetera. And we didn't care. We didn't care to be assimilated, say, like LULAC, the third generation, or the JFR, the second generation. We were the third one. Said, we're fine the way we are. My mother said, you estaba chulo y bonito, and my mother doesn't lie. So basically, this was a different animal. So when they looked at us, they said, well, who are these people? These people are crazy. Who in the hell is going to go up against the Texas Rangers? Well, we will. And people saw that. So vicariously, we emboldened a whole generation of people. And I'm telling you that there were demonstrations when we set the call out, we would have 3,000, 4,000 people show up. We took the Austin State Capitol over the school finance issue. We had about 5,000 people, okay? We not only came to the Capitol, but went through the police on Congress, took down the Texas flag and the American flag, put up the Mexican flag and the Mayo flag. That's why the flagpole today is on top of the Capitol as opposed to the front steps. They moved it. And they evacuated the governor, lieutenant governor, everybody. We had the whole building to ourselves. And there's photographs, looking at it from their perspective, they thought we were actually crazy, and they didn't know what to do with it. So that gives you respect. That gives you power. When someone doesn't know about you and doesn't know who you are, and then you throw a new word at them, we're Chicanos, you unstructure what little they know.
Jose Angel Gutierrez is the author of The Eagle Has Eyes, the FBI surveillance of Cesar Estrada Chavez of the United Farm Workers Union of America, 1965 to 1975. Gutierrez is a founding member of the Mexican-American Youth Organization and a founding member and past president of the Raza Unida Party. He's also served in a number of elected and appointed positions, including county judge of Zavala County and administrative law judge for the city of Dallas. The files on Cesar Chavez originally gathered for the book ended in 1975. Gutierrez recently heard that the FBI will release to him files on Chavez from 1975 to 1993, the year that he died.
I got to come up with money, a lot of money, because they charge 80 cents a page, and there's some like 3,040 pages, according to them. So you can do the math. I'm going to have to find some money or get a couple of speaking gigs to get a little honorarium so that I could pay for this and write the next book from 75 to 93.
Gutierrez is the author of numerous books, including The Making of a Chicano Militant, The Making of a Civil Rights Leader, and Tracking King Tiger, Reyes López Tijerina, and the FBI. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show online at tpr.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Bree Kirkham. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.